This is also like the whole every once in a while this discussion like rears up in some context of when people are going to the bathroom. Number two.
I, as soon as you said rears up, I was like, I know where this is going. Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 313 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm standing at a standing desk.
I'm Sam, and I got a knot in my back.
Yeah, this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is May 27th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. And before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity in this show. And we'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. They went over there and we grabbed their money.
Thanks for that.
All right, you guys, let's talk about life. Now, I want to talk about chairs.
Very important subject. Ooh. With the work from home phenomenon. Let's be real.
Now, we all live in chairs now. We've moved into Wall-E, you know, the movie Wall-E.
Yep.
Where everybody just lives in a floating chair. And the chair that you choose, it's very important. It's a lifelong companion that will determine just what your future is.
And you live there now.
You live there. It's your house.
It's sort of like a hermit crab.
You're like a hermit crab. Okay. So I've been using a bungee chair for the longest time, and I had some interesting revelations about desks, chairs, and people. You know, along the way.
Okay, that's a lot of it's a lot of elements to unpack.
So, for starters, I've come to believe that arms on chairs are a scam.
Oh, yeah, garbage. Take them 100%. Off. 100%. Rip them right off.
Okay. They're always really, really high. Mm-hmm. So that if you do rest your arms on there, even if you have great posture, you're in this fucked up shrugging position that just destroys your
whole body. And you can never get under the desk with it. You know?
Yep.
So, yeah. You can't then get close enough to the desk to have good posture because when you're typing – of course, I'm showing Sam and Seth over the video, but like
my arms like a goose.
Very accurate. Yeah, my arms are dangling at my – because like your arms just kind of hang. You know? They kind of hang there and then they – at roughly a 90-degree angle or whatever, they're on your keyboard, right? But if you're pushed back from the desk because the stupid arms are in the way
– then you got to reach forward.
Then you got to reach forward. And now you're basically like in a mummy pose, you know, while you're –
yeah. So one thing I've learned, get those arms off of that chair. If your chair has arms, get them off of there.
That's always the first thing I do is rip the arms off of my chair before I even sit in it. I just take the arms off.
So that's what I got this because I got this new chair and I was like, it's time to grow into a new shell. You know, my new hermit crab life.
How did you stay safe while you were moving between chairs?
Oh yeah, that's got to be a quick operation. You don't want one of those like
– you got to go fast.
Yeah,
you got to go. What you want to do is you want to stay in your one chair while you build the other one.
Right.
You know, and then you line them up next to each other and you do a quick shift off to the side.
That's actually what helps with removing the arms off both the chairs. So it actually really assists in that.
So you can slide across. Yeah. Well, but the thing is I got this new chair and I thought this is a much nicer chair than any chair I've ever had. And it has fully adjustable arms. And I was like, maybe I can keep the arms because maybe they'll actually go down to a level that is, you know, sort of respectable. That is acceptable for the human body, unlike every other chair I've ever used.
And you spent so much money on those arms because, you know, they're a significant portion of the chair.
That's true. They are. There's a lot of engineering that went into those arms.
They don't sell an armless variant like in the chair?
All office chairs must have arms. I don't know why this is where we've landed, but this is where we are as a society.
I think some of the really high-end ones, the ones that are like $1,000, you know, I think some of those you can opt out of having arms, I think.
Right, because it shaves like $100-$150 off. You know, that's like a whole chair's worth of arms off of that chair because it's so fancy at that point.
Yeah. So I got this chair put together. I was excited for the adjustable arms because I thought maybe it's time and I tried to lower them. Nope, you can't lower them lower than like the maximum height of most – you can raise them. You can go even higher than you know, is extremely uncomfortable or lower them to extremely uncomfortable. But you can't get them – so I ripped them off of there.
Good.
Okay. Good. But now I also have what I believe they call lumbar support.
Ooh, yeah.
But I don't know if now my lumbar is going to become unweakened because mm-hmm. now I'm not doing it. I'm not holding myself up. You know, the chair is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe you should get one of those chair balls. I guess it's just a ball. You get one of those balls.
It's just a ball.
And then, you know, and then half the time you sit on the ball and the other half the time. It's kind of like a standing desk. You know, like half the time you're standing, half the time you're sitting. And now the half the time that you're sitting, split that in half again. Half the time ball sit. The other half the time fancy chair sit. And then mm-hmm. keep that yeah. core strength.
So, you know, I feel like chair life is very fraught with a lot of traps, you know, and yeah. even stuff I think desks are also fucked up because desks are too tall, mm-hmm. right? Desks are too tall. Chairs are too tall. The arms of chairs are too tall. And I don't think any of these actually fit a person. Like, I don't think there's a person that if they just sat in like a standard height chair, a standard height desk with standard arms yep. – I don't think there's a singular human body that actually fits that.
I think there was – I believe all of these were invented by the same really tall guy. Like
a 6 foot four
hundreds
dude.
Of years ago. Yeah.
With shorter than average arms.
Yeah. He was just weirdly
much longer than average.
Taller. especially than for average the time. Torso.
Yeah. Maybe he was like a model. You know, he had a very long torso. You know,
he was like he was like a sort of a short-armed Michael Phelps, you know, kind of a
– Yeah, this could be – maybe the situation was – actually, so probably this guy didn't invent it, right? Because these things have been around for a long time. But probably what happened was that this weird-shaped dude was like, fuck, I can't – like everything is uncomfortable. Everything around me in my whole life is uncomfortable, right? So he sat down and he wrote a treatise about because it's like back in the 1800s in particular, like fucking people were writing all these treatises all the time that then – everybody else was like, oh, like this is the one book that I know exists. So this must be the truth, right?
And yeah. Like that's how
grammar rules work. You know, that's how like everything, all the rules that we live by today were some rando just decided here is the truth and wrote it down in one of the few books.
The first person to write it down won, basically. Yeah. That was the way it worked. Yeah.
So that's probably what happened. It was probably just the first book about chairs. There was a whole theory around it, like that, you know, a desk must be this height and a chair must be this height. So that, you know, and like the whole thing. And of course, at that time too, measurement systems were random, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's also
so
true.
Maybe this person was completely normally proportioned. But
and everything
then,
just got mixed up because somebody got their stones mixed with their feet.
Yeah. Or maybe they were like more of a, depending on kind of which background they had, maybe they're like on the puritanical side. And they were like, you should be very uncomfortable.
Work should that's be pain. Yeah. Work because should be pain. Pain cleanses the soul.
Yeah. Maybe it was maybe the Spanish Inquisition that invented.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you go. Oh, yeah,
it's possible that these are just torture devices.
You know, I've gone
co-opted.
Yeah, I've seen some of those museums. You walk into the torture exhibit, and there's just like a desk chair.
Yeah, and you're like, wait, this is just an office space. You know, you know that story about and I promise this point comes back. So you know the Moscow Mule drink, right?
Yes,
it's like a vodka and a ginger beer, right? And it always comes in that weird ass copper mug. At least, mm-hmm. like, if you're doing it right, supposedly, right? Apparently, this was because, like, back in the 20s or something, somebody had a fuckload of these copper mugs and no reason – and nobody wanted them, right? So they invented a drink that, like, was supposed to go in this vessel specifically so that they could sell these mugs, right? And so that's that's today, you know, capitalism. That's why we use those mugs, right? So what if Spanish Inquisition, mm-hmm. over, right? All these torture devices laying around. What are you going
to
do with
we got to offload it. We need, you know, we got to liquefy some assets.
Right. So they invent the modern office. Right?
Nobody's going to buy these chairs, you know, sort of like on purpose, unless they have some alternative cultural anchor point.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know,
so yeah, workplace is supposed to be unpleasant. It's supposed to be, you're not supposed to enjoy life, period. So let's get these in the home too while we're at it. And then. Just torture device. Now that way they don't have to, because they invested all that money into these torture mm-hmm. devices, you know, like
they just had warehouses full of these desks and chairs.
So you know? That's probably what happened.
That's 100%. Probably what happened. That's probably what happened. I'm no historian, but that sounds 100% accurate.
Yeah.
So, I think anyways.
But while we're on the topic though, because I haven't gotten to try this for myself yet because I myself do not have a fancy chair, but I've heard that the best thing you can do with a chair, not even like a necessarily fancy variety, but just an office chair with you know, casters, little rolling wheels, is replace those wheels with rollerblade wheels.
I've heard this.
Ooh, yes. Supposedly, this is just the best thing. because they're way smoother. So it's just like a better ride, you know.
They're rubber, so they have instead of plastic, because all officers have plastic wheels, so they just like make horrible, weird sliding things.
Yep. and they don't damage like any floor type. And then they're taller, and the way that they're structured makes it actually easier to get them over things, because the like chairs
you can get over like a carpet edge something.
Yeah, and you don't have to like have a mat and all that kind of stuff, supposedly. So it's this thing. I'm gonna be inheriting my wife's fancy chair soon because it's too tall for her, so she's getting a different one because, you know, chair's not the right size for people. But the first thing I'm going to do is
put the rollerblade wheels
on there and see what happens.
Can you get, like, little shocks also and turn it into, like, a true off-roading chair situation?
You want some pretty rigid ones, I would think.
And would you get a shock per wheel, or would you just get a shock for the, like, sort of unicycle post thing that's coming up?
I think all of it.
Just the whole thing. Sort of wobbly.
You want a really good suspension system in your off-roading office chair, I feel. Because you don't want to feel every like ramp that you go off of. It should be very smooth. So anyways, so chairs, you know, they're terrible, and yeah, it's always a journey. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Jiffy Lube.
Okay. So yesterday, driving over to Seth and Sampy's house to have our first ever kind of quarantine break thing, which we'll talk about after this. But on the way there, I was like, oh, my tire light's been on for a little bit. Don't really drive the car too much, but this seems like a perfect moment to swing by Jiffy Lube and have them jiff it up, you know, just whatever that means, just spiff this thing up.
Lube it.
So this, I think, is one of those stories about how a person who's an expert in something can so thoroughly like forget that other people don't understand what is happening, because I go rolling into the Jiffy Lube. Guy comes over to chat, rolled down my window, and he's like, hey, what do you need? And I was like, all right, very friendly off the bat, feeling a little weird about this already, but it's fine. And I was like, I just got this light on for my tires thing. I've been filling them up. It's not really doing anything, so I'm not sure exactly. If you guys can just check it out and tell me what's going on. And he's like, okay, so you're here for our top off service. And I was like, I'm not super sure.
Is that what that is?
Or and he was like, top off service, we'll check all your fluids, fill them all up for you, fill up your tires, that sort of thing. And I was like, will that specifically be trying to address this light issue? Because it doesn't quite sound like that. And he's like, look.
Look, you idiot.
Yeah, he's like, look. Had you been filling up these tires? And I was like, yeah, at the gas station, like literally across the street. And he's like, okay, listen. If you fill up your tires too much, the light will also come on. And I was like, okay. And he's like, and if you underfill it, it will come on. And I was like, yeah. Okay, I got
there's a 2 PSI range in the middle.
Yeah.
That you've got to just nail.
Yeah.
And then he's like,
these are pretty wide.
You have to overfill the crap out of them, I'm pretty sure.
And then he's like, and you don't fill it based on the pressure listed on the tire. But actually, there's a pressure listed on the inside of the door.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, this was a fact I did not know. You guys knew this already?
Yeah.
I did not know this. So it mixed in with this weird, like, I apparently should work there already and know everything about what they're doing, sort of condescension thing was happening.
I really can't believe you didn't know about their top off service.
I know. Mm-hmm. What? Or how
one of their top 17 services.
Yeah, or how like a TPMS system works, which is like the tire pressure management system. Of course, in a Honda CRV, how do you not know that this light, if you just press and hold this button for 2 seconds, it'll read something?
How do you not know?
It was one of those weird experiences where like I learned something, which is useful. But in the context of a very uncomfortable interaction where the guy – I just felt like he was just talking to me like I was so dumb. And I was like, yep. I mean, I am dumb, but I don't know why that's a problem. And like I'm coming here because I'm dumb. That's like what I'm here for, my dumbness. And it was just very –
That's why this guy gets to have a job, is because other people –
Yeah, because I'm so dumb.
They don't know about this stuff. And they just want him to take care of it.
So instead of him appreciating like, oh yeah, the reason I'm here is because most people don't know these things.
Instead,
it's I can't believe people don't know these things.
Yeah, that was the vibe the whole time. Even like when he was talking about specific mechanical things, which seems more reasonable, but also when he was talking about like very specific service things from Jiffy Lube, and I was like, I don't know any.
It does make sense that like as far as your car's PSI light thing, that like it's the car it's the car has its own idea of what is an appropriate level of pressure that's baked into the telemetry of the car, not the tires. Like now that you say that, I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense why that would be the case. But also it would never have occurred to me because I've been having this, like my tire pressure light comes on all the time.
It might be
I go check it. Pressure's perfectly fine according to the what the tires say, right? Now, ideally, you would be able to just tell your car, hey, here's the pressure that my tires are supposed to be instead of the car just having a fixed – like why is there no options panel where I can like turn up the graphics settings of my car and I can
turn your graphics on tire three? Yeah.
Yeah. That would be – I think that would – that's well, that's probably too much control. You know?
Yeah, it's way too much control.
You know, yeah, it's yeah, you don't want.
Well, it is also weird too, right? Because that implies though that no matter what kind of tires you have, since you've decoupled the pressure from inside the tire with the tire itself, right? That you get some get like so you're in like you got my Ford Focus, right? What if I got some off-roading tires on that thing? Monster truck tires, right? I don't think supposed to still be at 32 psi in the front. Seems unlikely.
Good question.
And then if I have them at 32 psi, does that mean I have to like? At that point, probably disable the onboard computer that like checks the pressure because now it can't possibly know. You know?
What if you got rollerblade wheels in the front?
What if I had rollerblade wheels? Don't even have PSI.
Don't even have PSI. You should be able to tell your car like, don't even worry about those. They're very smooth. Yeah. They give great suspension.
Yeah, I think actually the funny thing here is while you're saying you didn't know about like the interior car door thing that tells you the pressures, you know? For whatever reason, I knew that that's where I could get the pressures, you know? And so I don't know if I knew or not that the tire itself has the pressure on it. Like it's obvious that it should, you know, now that you say that. But I've literally never looked there because I always knew that I could look in the door, you know. But I don't remember being taught that like the door is where you get them instead of the tire. I just like at some point was taught or saw or whatever that's where pressures are. So I could just like look at that.
Well, to be fair, in both cases, this information is completely hidden, and especially on the tire. Because, like, at least if you open the door, that sticker is actually – I was like, that is a very loud sticker. It's like
– oh, yeah.
It's like
yeah,
white. It's like there.
It's
the tire, of course, like, I mean, it's written in embossed black leather on – or black rubber on black rubber. So it's
it's a harder spot.
You got to go. You got to really know what you're looking for.
Isn't it kind of interesting that there are – this reminds me of there's so many things in life that everybody just kind of – landed on a certain way of doing it, right? But these are the kinds of things that you almost – that other people almost never see you doing, right? Right? Like,
you mean like filling up tires? What do you mean?
Yeah. Like if you're checking your tire pressure, the only time you do that when somebody else is around you, like a significant other or whatever, is like if you are on the side of the road and something has gone wrong. Normally, you know, like you'll check that shit when you're on your own, right?
So you don't get critique.
It's not like a socialized thing then. Yeah, right. It's like no one has seen you be a dummy about how
this is also like the whole every once in a while this discussion like rears up in some context of when people are going to the bathroom, number two.
As soon as you said rears up, I was like, I know where this is going.
Because there's two – like there's these like two variables that are apparently like all over the place, like surprisingly equal the population in terms of how they're used, which are when both related to wiping, which first is do you sit or stand or like something in between, right? And the second one is do you wipe front to back or back to front, which – and the funny thing is that latter question to me like the – it seems horrifying that the other – like the other direction seems horrifying, right? Relative to what I know, which I'm not going to specify.
because yours might be equally horrifying.
Yeah, I don't want to admit whatever it is.
The other faction.
But this idea because like that's the same thing. It's like nobody sees you do that, right?
Yeah, you don't get a lot of critique.
Yeah, nobody sees you doing those two things. And so then at some point somebody like just says one of the things that you know, like as if it's like obvious that that's how that thing works. And then like literally half of all people are like, what? You know, that's what? It's like that's literally that's the wrong way to do it. And
well, it's the aphantasia thing, right? I didn't know that other people had this experience, right? Yeah. Like there are certain experiences that you have that are either so internal or so private. And weirdly, checking tire pressure is a very private thing. And you would never see – I would never like be in the car with you, Adam, and then you'd be like, oh shit, hold on. I got to check my tires. And then like you would open your door and like look on the inside of the door, and I'd be like, what are you looking at the door for?
Yeah.
I thought you said you were going to check the tire pressure, right?
Yeah.
And then you would say, well, the requirement's right there. Then I would say, no, it's not. It's on the tires. Mm-hmm. And we would both say, what?
And then we would Google it and find out whatever the definitive truth is.
Right? Yeah. But which that of course, would never happen.
And that can't really be like, to me, because you're decoupling the thing that holds the air, right? From the thing that knows about how much air is in there, right? And the thing that holds the air can change.
This is just a, it's just a disaster waiting to happen.
It just doesn't seem like it could possibly be
the,
true.
That the PSI leak on your tire is the max amount for that tire.
Mm, okay.
But that's also not true.
Well, I mean, it is. It's the max pressure that it's you should like have
the
tire
max safe, the max safe pressure.
Well, yeah, it's the max that you should, but it's not the max that it can actually handle.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, I mean, that's not a useful number to have on there because – then people will shoot for it.
Yeah, people will fill it up to explosive levels, which is horrifying.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's this is as a brief side note about this idea of like people just kind of landing on their own way of doing stuff and never getting like feedback on it or whatever. One of the things that I've been doing in our WoW guild is I started up a little sort of mentorship program. For people who are having kind of like a harder time doing well in the raids that we do, and like they want to do more damage, they want to do like just do better at the game. And one of the services that I'm providing, I'm just doing it for fun, right? But like one of the things that I'm doing for people is they actually screen share and they play, and I take a look at how they've set up their interface, how they've set up all their key bindings and everything, and it's fascinating because all you ever see in this game is the person's character walking around doing stuff. You never see
the insane what buttons
they're hitting. Yep. You never see like the like if somebody's like, yeah, I die all the time, you know. And then it turns out that they've like moved their health bar off to some weird far off corner where they can't fucking see it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just like, why don't you just like move that, like put that where you can see it, you know? But. Because the focus of feedback that they would get from people is always just on the consequence of what they did, right? Yep. Which is like so – people just be like, pay more attention and stop dying so much, right? When really there's actually just like an easy structural thing that nobody can see except for the person who needs to
even that person can't see it though because they're used to it, right? This is also an allegory for mental health, exactly. Right? Where it's just like like if you've got ADHD and people around you are like, just fucking remember things. Just pay more attention. Mm-hmm. You know, just like stop just making
focus.
A mess.
It totally focus, is.
You know?
Yeah, and like, fidgeting.
Like there was somebody who had been just like really, really struggling. They seemed to know a lot about the game and they knew a lot about like what they were supposed to be doing and how to play their character and stuff. And so I go and I look, we have like logs. We have this, it's like the craziest analytics you can imagine for like how in depth you can go to analyze what somebody does on like a given, you know, fight in this game. And it turns out that this guy was just like casting spells like 30% less frequently than everybody else. Like he just was doing less. And so then when I watched him play, he was clicking at all of his abilities. So he like – so instead of having hotkeys for stuff, he had to like use his mouse to find the button on the interface click it, right? And that was it. Like that was the one thing, right? But nobody knew that was happening, right? It's an internal thing that only he can see. And so all the feedback he gets is about how – like you said, Adam, how he needs to try harder. He needs to do better, blah, blah, blah. But there's this like structural thing happening inside of his computer – that if he has a different way of handling that, then suddenly the output changes, right?
Yep.
So it really is like such a mental health allegory. All these invisible things that are structurally happening on the inside that are changing the output, but all you get feedback on is the output.
Yeah, and we're all just used to judging the output, you know.
So. And you only get judged on the output.
Yep.
And the solution you're always presented with is try harder, you know, work harder.
But I think that's why it's so challenging to get help with any of these basically invisible things, whether it's mental health or even just like, ergonomic support for your own like office chair, whatever the fuck, because relaying what's happening is not as easy as screen sharing in like a video game context.
Well, right? But also you often don't know.
You don't even know. Yeah.
And so you don't have a thing because the guy didn't sit down and say, hey, I don't know how to use hotkeys. Right.
He didn't know. Yeah.
He didn't know. He didn't know to think about hotkeys as a thing. So he didn't realize that could be
because he can't see me using my hotkeys. Like I'm not I'm not showing him what I'm doing. Or even if I did, he may not have even like noticed that that was what I was doing.
He wouldn't necessarily map that on.
Because he wouldn't be looking for
it. Well, I think it's the same thing with learning. You know, it's like I've been talking with my wife about this quite a bit because she's gotten more and more interested in making robots because I've been trying to get her to program for a long time. And it's like every once in a while I'll be like, don't teach programming. Like, how about now? You know? And she just rolls her eyes each time, you know. But because
she's the first part of the hero's journey, they have to resist the call, Adam.
That's exactly
right. Resist the call to action.
She's on the course.
Also, okay, I was gonna say if that doesn't work, try growing a longer beard.
Ooh, yeah.
Because the wizened person who pulls in the hero is supposed to have like a really huge white beard.
You just gotta get older.
You gotta Gandalf it.
But because we were talking about the learning process of programming, right? And how just how shitty it is.
Yeah.
And how many people – you hear about people who are trying to learn programming and you see the kind of stuff that you're doing. And you see all this aspirational stuff too of like people who are just over the first hump telling everybody else like, oh yeah, you just got to stick with it. And people are just like trying so hard to kind of help each other, you know, up through all this – through this process. And but the reason it's hard is because of how it's taught. And not only that – it's hard because of what it is, because programming was invented by people, right? It was just invented by people. And so they came up with all these ideas that once
there's
you understand
no obvious, them, like, there's no obvious, like, natural law.
No, there isn't. Like, yeah. It's
how math works, for example, which was also invented by people, but also it follows an inbuilt intuition, right? Like, you take two and you have two more, and now there's four. And, like, you can do stuff with that in the world.
Yeah. Leap from that to the concept of addition that always works, right?
Yeah.
Is enormous, and it's not intuitive. It's like it feels like it is now because like it makes sense, right?
Right.
But it actually isn't. And so you take all of these things that are not intuitive, that are actually tools built by people, where those people who built those tools were way ahead of where you are right now because they had to derive them conceptually, right? They had to invent these ideas in order to use a tool that would do something, or because they were struggling to achieve some goal, and then they realize that if they just did this thing in a certain way, they could do it. Now, here you come, you know, 20 years later, 100 years later, 200 years later, right? And you're not dealing with the problems that they were dealing with. You don't have the background those people were dealing with. You don't know Latin like all those fuckers did, right? And so now here you come and you're trying to figure out, okay.
Or Greek
or any of these things, right?
Greek letters everywhere.
So then you come in and you're like, okay. I want to learn programming because this like seems useful. Everybody's talking about it, right? And you can't quite figure out exactly what it's for because nobody can articulate that to you. It just seems like it's cool, and like you're like, oh, I can make video games with it. I guess I don't know what that means, but like it's a thing I could do. I can make websites.
Well,
and
much like art, if you said like I want to learn art, well, it's like okay, digital painting, drawing, sculpture. Yeah. Like there's a thousand different angles you could take, and all of them are art,
you
and
can they're start all anywhere.
They're going to be useful and more useful in certain contexts and less useful in others.
Yep.
And depending on what you want to do with it, you may have picked the wrong starting point. You know,
but you can't know what starting point to
you
pick.
You can't
know what teacher to pick because all the ones you can find are the ones that you are available to you via searching or locally or however you look for people, right? And so you're using really fucking impartial or really partial information to search a very limited pool to try to find a mechanism by which you can learn something that you don't even know what it is you're trying to learn actually because you don't know it yet. And so you don't know how to evaluate whether somebody can teach you, right? And then now you go like find something because other people – however it is you find it. Other people talk about it, whatever, right? And then you get there and like then now the teacher doesn't know what you know. They already know the stuff, right? And so since they already know the stuff, then they can't comprehend what it's like to not know it, right?
You know what it sounds like?
And it just keeps on going. So the end result is that like – it's amazing anybody can learn anything, and it's not surprising at all that it's hard as fuck to learn stuff. It's so hard, and it's all presented
you know
as like
you
just
is,
gotta
Adam.
You just gotta study harder, or you just gotta or like this is obvious or whatever, right? But it's all just it's basically an impossible situation.
No, there's something missing here. We're missing something as like a society. Okay, we have teachers who know the source material and they give you the knowledge, right? But what we're missing is the matchmaking service, like the person who still knows all the stuff, right? But their whole job is to spend a bunch of time with you to figure out what you know and what you don't know,
and what you're trying to do,
and what you're trying to do, and then get you hooked up with the right materials.
Yeah. Well,
right? It's not their job to teach you the materials. It's their job to
find the
identify resource. What your knowledge is and isn't.
Yeah, but there are entities that kind of like behave as if that's what they're doing, like Udemy and other places, right?
I would say that's what a mentor does generally too.
That's what a mentor is, yeah. Typical, yeah.
But that's assuming that the mentor like – because the mentor can know a whole bunch of that stuff, but they don't necessarily know like all the – so as an example, so me as a person definitely with ADHD and then maybe with a touch of autism spectrum, the way that I need to learn stuff is not the same as the way that somebody else might, because I need to be deeply engaged and I don't care about and can't remember facts, right? I can't remember just like, oh – This is the thing. Like this is like just memorize this. As long as you memorize all these things, you're fine. I have to know why.
You operate more on logical relationships and connections,
and concepts, right? So I need to understand why. So when I'm trying to learn something, if you just give me let's build an app together, and that's what we do. At the end of that, I'm like, I didn't learn fucking anything, right? Because what I need is to say like, okay, what is programming? What is it for? Who invented it? You know, and like why? What problem were they trying to solve? Because if I can start there, then the whole time I'm engaged, and then by the time I get to finally put my hands on the keyboard to do something, I'm like, yeah, I know what I'm trying to accomplish here, right? And I can see each piece of it in relation to that. Mm-hmm. But that learning style is really boring to lots of other people with different backgrounds or different kinds of brains, right? And so, because this is what my wife and I were talking about, is because of the way that her brain works, all the coursework she takes, she's like, I don't care about this. I don't care about this, right? Like it's so hard to focus. And so it's just all this stuff is the same problem, which is just really interesting, right? That there's this invisibility of what it is that you need to know, what you actually know, how your brain works, the different things that are in your way relative to some other thing, some other piece of knowledge, right? You don't even know that they're in the way because
you can't see them and nobody else can see them.
Yeah.
And we have no,
because you can only see them relative to the knowledge, which you don't have yet. And other people who have the knowledge can only see it relative to who you are, if they understood and were able to fully put themselves in your shoes with understanding, which is an incredibly difficult capability that most people don't have. So
I still learning just think is about hard. How wild it is that I had taken comp sci in college, failed, had written off the idea that I was capable of computer programming.
Yeah, and you hear that constantly from people. They're just like, oh, I'm just not good at math. Oh, I just like – I tried to program. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's an assessment of the self instead of an assessment based on the structure that was given, which like to be fair, like you can't always just offload all responsibility for any shortcomings you have onto like, you know, structural stuff. But actually, it's always shared. It's always shared, and oftentimes far more so on the structural side than on the personal side.
Might be able to offload almost all responsibility. Because I think about like there was that article called like Laziness Doesn't Exist, which is an amazing article. Definitely, whoever's listening, just Google that article and check it out. It's just a really interesting.
Yeah, it's on Medium. It was really popular. Like I think 2018 is when it came out, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the idea that that as a person you would just say like, oh, I hate and am bad at math. I hate and am bad at writing or music or whatever. But there's also a whole bunch of other stuff that you're super passionate about and are good at, right? Which to me says like you are capable of learning things, getting excited about them and being good at them. Mm-hmm. And what makes like math so different from art? What makes music so different from programming or whatever? Like to me it doesn't make sense that you would have like a complete incapability of migrating passions from one thing to another. And it's more of an access point or a structural problem where, because like in my case, like I was getting super interested in like business and finance and stuff, right? But that only came at the end of my college career after I had changed majors 7 times. I failed out of computer science. I tried like exercise science, marketing. I was just like floating around trying to find something. And the one thing that got me pumped about finance was just this one professor who I had like every finance course with the same guy in the same semester. Like I had 5 classes with this one guy who was really, really intense. And it was just awesome, right? And like the way he talked about stuff, it seemed so applicable and practical that I could just like see all the interesting use cases of the stuff that he was presenting, right? So it wasn't the case that like finance is boring, because actually like that's one of those things that people would definitely describe as being like not very interesting.
Yeah, right? your classic example is like, oh, accounting, you know,
and
like
accounting,
like when people need to cite like a boring profession, you know, like that's the one.
Yeah, they land on that. Yeah.
Have you seen the complex, interesting problems that accountants have to solve? They're like,
it's amazing.
We have a tax code that is like mutually contradictory and 7,000 pages long, right? And their job is to understand the logical, the complexity of that thing well enough and your situation well enough that they can like find a way to keep you from going to jail.
Yeah.
And right? also pay as few taxes as possible at the same time. Right. Yeah. And it's like, and the more they try to push for those two things to happen at the same time, the more likely it is that they get themselves and you into trouble. Right. And that's their job. That's amazing. You're like racing against the government, you know? Yeah.
And that's like the quintessential boring job.
It's pretty rebellious when you get down to it, you know?
Yeah. But it's all about framing. It's all about these structural access points. We're like, yeah, you know, if you had an accounting professor in college or something, who was, you know, kind of like showing up in their beige shirts, you know, and they're just like, okay, well, today we're going to open to chapter 3 and we're going to talk about inventory management, you know. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, obviously that sucks, right? But
the subject doesn't suck.
No subject is boring. It's just I don't know. Anyways. How did we get here? Oh, yeah, we're talking about Jiffy Lube. I want to talk a little bit about our flexible work hours stuff, because that's been ongoing. And Sam, I think you had some thoughts about that.
And then we'll have time for like 0-1 questions.
Point 0.03. We can read a question. Well, maybe like a little bit cliffhanger, and we'll answer it next time.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to keep it short, but it's just sort of reiterating the experience we've had since. So Adam basically like just tried this flexible schedule thing maybe 2 months back now.
Something like that,
and then had such a good time with it that we were like, oh, let's just kind of more broadly just be like, you know what, everybody can choose your hours, just pick like 7 hours in the day that you're like working, you know, that's kind of what we're asking for. But you know what, put them basically wherever the fuck you want. We'll do our stand-up at 9 a.m but otherwise like whatever, do whatever you want.
And just otherwise work with people that you need to collaborate and make sure that, you know, so don't choose a random time and force someone to meet you there, you know, but like
and ideally don't
be reasonable.
Yeah, it's all, well, it's about being conscientious, right? But like, yep. But also with a tremendous amount of flexibility. And so I've been taking 1 to 3 offs, but it's just sort of like that for me, that's always been my kind of my lull anyways, right? That's where I get a little bit cloudy. I'm like kind of basically want to take a nap sort of thing. And that doesn't change with being medicated for ADHD either. Like
it's just your rhythm.
Yeah, it's just my rhythm. And so my wife and I have also been taking care of a lot of this like outside the house stuff, cleaning up the yard, like a bunch of that sort of usual spring, summertime stuff. And I gotta say, like the flexible schedule that allows you to then switch from like intense sort of working, creating, talking to people mode to just like manual brute force for like 45 minutes. And then it's still enough time to go take a shower, get cleaned up, and like, you know, maybe even like read a bit or play like a short match of a game or something like that, and then pop back into work. I've been like easily from both a mental standpoint, handling all of the stuff that previously was always trying to be shoved into like that, like very uncomfortably into that like 5 to 10 PM block where I was like, I'm already like done. I don't want to do any of this. And now
you're like making errors and you're just like,
yep,
just doing random stuff to distract yourself that you don't need to be doing. It doesn't actually help.
And instead now I'm doing that sort of like, it's somehow it ends up being a restorative thing that supports the creative endeavor on like sort of this, you know, general life stuff or work stuff in this context. And isn't tiring in the same kind of way that it was before. And again, a structural thing. Why is it that maybe you hate doing this this yard work thing? Is it because you hate yard work, or is it because it always happens after a full day of work or on the weekend when you have like 36 hours of like not having to worry about stuff, and now you actually just have a thing that blocks out like a huge chunk of it, you know?
Well, there are people who really enjoy gardening, really enjoy doing that kind of stuff, right? And so again, it's like, is the activity fundamentally unenjoyable, or have you landed in a structural scenario that just makes it suck?
Yes,
every time. Yeah,
but also the people who are really into it, and you know, it's sort of a there's a you know
cause effect problem here, right? But the people who are really into it, like you tend to, because like our dad's a good example. He's like in the garden every day. He gets home from work, just does some stuff in the garden, right? And he just kind of always has, right? The people who hate it, or at least find it like aggravating and try to put it off, right? Like me, it's like, okay, whatever I can get away with. So it's like, at some point I'll look outside and be like, oh God, that place is fucked, right? And so
basically large batch delivery.
Yep. So then I get out there and it's going to be like, okay, well, I need a large batch of time where it's not going to cook me alive, right? So it's going to be like, so Saturday morning probably. So then Saturday morning, which is usually now I'm just like, such a slow morning, you know? I just like get up.
Just want to relax, man.
Just have some coffee, relax, you know? Now I'm looking at the clock in seconds. I'm like, oh God, it's going to start getting hot, right? So like now my morning is starting to get fucked up. And then finally, I'm like, okay, fine, I'll go outside. And I go, you know, start doing it. But I'm out there for like 4 hours, you know. I come inside. It's now been hot for most of those 4 hours. So like now I need a nap. Got to shower and get ready for the day. But it's like noon or two.
And you're tired now. I'm tired. It's almost as if it's not that you hate gardening, but you hate being really hot, sweaty, and tired for 4 hours at a time.
On a morning when I'm supposed to just be like – lazing about.
Oh, what's supposed to be?
Yeah, that's a funny one. Yeah, if you remove the name of the activity from the thing that you dislike, what does it sound like? You know, what's the context that you're being baked in with that, right? Because that might be a good way to kind of diagnose where there's more of a structural thing happening than a non-structural one. So, anyways, that's the sort of yard work and flexible schedule story that I had on my side.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when you can kind of extrapolate this beyond just the idea of like, taking breaks in a flexible schedule and more just about whatever it is that you're doing, even if it is something that you enjoy doing, can become more or less enjoyable depending on the framing of the time. So I think one interesting thing that's happened this week is we were working on doing some updates to the existing games and just trying to, you know, we're trying to keep them maintained, keep them from crashing, you know, all that good stuff. And one of the things that we found is that we have a few kind of like outstanding issues with our file management system, which straddles all of our games. And it's a really important system, especially for consoles, which have a bunch of rules about how you can handle saving and loading of files. And so I've been taking some time this week to update that thing. And it's honestly been really cathartic for me because – this thing has just kind of been like spitting out random problems for us that are kind of like we always have to look into them and we always have to ask like, is this really is this a big problem? Is this going to cause players to lose data or is it a red herring? Is it actually fine? But we keep having to kind of just look at it, you know? And so it's been really great for me to be able to go in and just do work on this thing, just really like rip its guts out, just rebuild it to be really robust and strong and more reliable. But at the same time, I want to be working on Crashlands 2, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that like this thing goes into Crashlands 2. Like it's part of the Crashlands 2 game system, right? And so in a tangential way, I am working on Crashlands 2, but also I'm just refactoring a thing that already existed. So I'm not adding something. I'm just sort of fixing something. But because of the framing of it, which is that like we didn't specifically say, okay, you know what, like every Wednesday is like refactoring and maintenance and fixing all of your shit kind of a day. Then any time that goes into some kind of big maintenance overhaul emotionally is going to feel like I need to just get it done so I can get back to the real work, you know? And so it is kind of harder to enjoy that work as fun as it is and as much as I am excited about the outcome of having something that's just much better in the end, it still feels weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think this is the challenge of like – I think from a management standpoint, when you're looking at stuff like tech debt to burn down, which essentially this is.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, figuring out a way to frame it not just to yourself but also to the rest of your team with regards to essentially what that story is – that's exciting about it. Like, why is this actually a very exciting thing to work on? And then, you know, prioritizing those things over adding new features in because it's actually a more exciting story. It's a more exciting addition to the game, even if it's a refactor or like an edit of a thing, you know, from previously. And I think that's really the challenge on there. And I think people kind of lack the tools to be able to like talk about to be able to talk about that in a way that, because it's so easy to just get in the weeds about like why it's such a, you know, why it's such an issue, or even like the interesting solve, as opposed to being able to say really high level and basically saying like being able to solve this problem both like sets the stage for Crescens 2's entire save system, and at the same time will robustly refactor and improve all of our previous games such that managing everything downstream from them is going to be easier, which means we'll have even more time for Crescens 2 stuff in the future, right?
Yeah.
But it's so hard to have that as opposed to just like fix it. Right.
Yeah, but the hard part is, you know, all the framing is about sort of like, we're going to be fixing fewer bugs. It's going to be easier to maintain. All of our existing games will generate, you know, fewer problems, and it's going to be easier to do file operations on all of our future games, right? But those are all sort of like time and effort, like features, as opposed to like, we have this cool new explosion effect in the game. Look how cool it is, right? And I think that's the hard part, is like a lot of the important work, and even thinking about like, the idea of like weeding your garden. You haven't planted anything, right? And like it kind of just over time became progressively more of an eyesore until eventually you spent 4 hours on a Saturday getting sweaty, you know, and ripping all the weeds out, which is definitely an improvement, but it's more of a reset, right? Like you haven't structurally made your garden way better. You've just gotten it back to what you would now once again consider to be like a fine state.
I think it's a much harder pitch. It's the difference is focusing on the developer experience just as much as the user experience, right? Which is becoming like is becoming all the rage recently in the sort of the tech industry, the part that moves really fast. You know, is there are people actually whose jobs now are just like, they call it DX, developer experience, right? Whose jobs are just like to make sure that's really good, you know. And
it should be fun and easy to work on the product.
Yeah. And if you think about it, is that the product in development, the product has a bunch of audiences, right? But the two main ones are the person who will experience it, your user, right? Where you get UX, and then the person who's making it, or the people who are making it, which is your DX, right? And so if you think about these things as like, okay, yeah, like developer experience is really important. You just decide that that's true. Then now all of a sudden it's really easy to say, okay, well, the existence of this janky system that throws chaos into the system periodically, that then makes it so suddenly at random, there's now an issue that we have to go deal with, right? Or so that now every time you work on the save system, you're a little concerned about
– and kind of confused.
And kind of confused, right? And you're never quite sure you can trust it. And that's your experience using that system, right? So you're just kind of always afraid. Then, you know, that's not a good developer experience to have.
Think about how wild this is, though, that like that the idea of designing for a good experience for your developers is sort of like
– is new.
Yeah, it's a new thing. Or so, you know, think about, you know, a company like Microsoft. And they've got like 80,000 people. They have this huge campus, right? And that that there wouldn't be like an entire division – of that company that is dedicated toward, for example, like the EX, you know, the employee experience. Like
it should be absolutely – and there might be. I have no – like, yeah, I don't know what goes on over there, right?
I'm gonna code skeptical on that.
But this would be your onboarding and management and HR, like how all that stuff is put together. Yeah, it would be your employee experience.
Yeah. The reason I say I'm skeptical is because every time I've logged in to any Microsoft product, I am absolutely – confused as fuck.
It is because, very confusing experience.
Because over the years, they've acquired so many companies and then like integrated those login systems into their own login system, but somehow kept them separate. I am just, I'm in a maze, you know? And this is as like a tech person. You know, like I have a hard time.
And the downstream consumer whose experience presumably is where most of the investment is going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so I would be skeptical that there would be like an internal division of the company whose whole job is to identify bad experiences that any employee might have, whether it's like scheduling, whether it's calendars, meetings, whether it's getting good feedback on stuff, knowing what they're doing, or just questions like how much of this person's time gets derailed by random unplanned things. You know, like downstream bugs.
There's a study that came out last month or something like that where you know, the Microsoft study where they were like, oh yeah, back-to-back Zoom meetings are really bad for people. And it's like, you didn't have to do a study to figure that out. You could
just
be a person. And I, but I think that's what it is. It seems like people are slowly coming around, people in businesses, slowly coming around to the idea that like contorting people around into a really weird shape around like a system.
You take a system and you're like, this is inflexible. And then you fucking jam people into it. They're like bleeding and their arms are flying off, right? Yep. And you're like, no, but the sanctity of the system, that we spent a lot of money on this system. Yeah. So don't touch it. Leave it alone.
Or even just the structures, right? Even just work structure, like the work hours that you work, all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It seems like people are, and I think the remote work thing from the pandemic is what caused a lot of this to kick off in the more on the mainstream side. But like, it feels like people are larger portion of the population is kind of coming around to the idea that like building a system that works for actual people
who differ from one another,
who are different,
and are not robots, which are the two facts that people in business really seem to forget about. This person's resume like has the same title, so I can just fire this one and put right, that's fine, right? I can just do that.
You could do like back-to-back Zoom meetings for like 10 hours, right?
Yeah,
you never get tired.
They're not overlapping, infinite. So what's the problem?
Yeah, and of course, like you would never do that with meetings. So why would you start doing it with Zoom meet? Like, what is it about having the word Zoom in front of it that suddenly changes the framing?
Well, it probably is part of the danger there, actually, of the remote work is it gets easier to think of people as robots because they're interacting through robot interfaces,
emails,
right?
and text and
stuff. And you're just like, oh, it's a Zoom call, so like a robot turns it on, right? And like it gets scheduled by a robot and all this kind of stuff. And just like with any algorithm, like algorithms are designed by people, robots are made by people, and if the people who make it aren't thinking about people when they do it, and they're just thinking about the like, oh yeah, we need to be able to set meetings. Like, what does it mean to have a meeting? Like, okay, well, it has a start and a finish. And typically people think of them as like a half hour, an hour. So boom, there's our meeting system. And they don't think about the next thing of like, okay, well, what if somebody has two meetings and they're a person, right? And now they need to get from one to the next.
Wait, what if our customers are people?
Yeah, what if they're people though?
Wait, what if our employees are actually people? Like, oh, fuck.
It's wild to me that as a, especially like as a large company that has a large number of employees, which also means – let's say you've got 1,000 employees. You know, how many of them are going to leave this year, and how many are you going to hire this year? You know, quite a bit, probably, mm-hmm. right? Even if it's like, even if you have low turnover, and you have like out of 1,000 people, 50 of them leaving this year, and 50 of them coming in. That's a lot of institutional knowledge that's leaving your company, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of time that you have to spend training up new people, right? And so the idea that and I mean, like talk to any person who works in a company of that size or larger, and they could write you a treatise about the number of just absolutely mind-bogglingly horrible experiences that they have to go through to just do simple things at their job, and that somehow internally at the company it is just not at all a priority to make it easy and
good,
fun and good to be there, you know, like
do better.
It seems like such an easy win. Like if your whole job is like to design good experiences for your customers and provide a good product for your customers, like why can't you take that same mindset toward the people who make the experiences for the customers? Mm-hmm. Do you think miserable employees make good experiences for a customer? I think it's probably harder for them to do that. So anyways, do better.
Mm-hmm.
Do better, everybody. All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have for this week. So we will go hard on the questions next week.
Yep.
I think that's a fair.
We're
getting into a rhythm here, you know, just a day of bloviating and a day of questions, just week by week. So, all right. Well, we'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.